D-Radio Wissen. Hörsaal. Rein in den Elfenbeinturm. Es gilt das gesprochene Wort. In Universitäten, Akademien und Forschungszentren. Die großen Köpfe der Vergangenheit. Die besten Hirne der Gegenwart.
Mit Sibylle Salewski. Es gehört zum Kerngeschäft der Ökonomen, wirtschaftliche Entwicklungen vorauszusagen. Doch allzu oft klappt das leider überhaupt nicht. Die globale Wirtschaftskrise habe bewiesen, so sagt es der Nobelpreisträger Joseph Stiglitz, dass die makroökonomischen Standardmodelle versagt haben. Sie konnten die Krise nicht vorhersagen und haben dann deren Auswirkungen auch noch massiv unterschätzt. Deshalb müssen die Wirtschaftswissenschaften sich neu erfinden. Wie? Das erklärt Joseph Stiglitz heute hier bei uns im D-Radio Wissen Hörsaal. Stiglitz ist Professor für Wirtschaftswissenschaften an der Columbia University in New York. Er war Vizepräsident und Chefökonom der Weltbank. In seinem Vortrag Imagining an Economics That Works – Crisis, Contagion and the Need for a New Paradigm plädiert Stiglitz dafür, dass sich die Wirtschaftswissenschaften den wahren Problemen zuwenden. Ungleichheit, Armut, Umweltzerstörung. Um das zu tun, müssen sie neue ökonomische Modelle erfinden. Joseph Stiglitz hat seinen Vortrag am 26. August 2011 gehalten, beim vierten Treffen der Wirtschaftsnobelpreisträger in Lindau am Bodensee.
What I'm going to do today is to focus on some aspects of modern macroeconomics. As it should be clear, a little bit in contrast to some others that may have spoken, I don't think this has been exactly a golden moment for macroeconomics. In fact, as I mentioned 2 days ago, the standard models that are used by central banks and by most economists didn't predict the crisis. In fact, it's remarkable, the last meeting of Lindau was in 2008, in August of 2008. I don't know if you remember, you're probably too young, to remember what happened in September of 2008. It was the beginning of the global economic crisis. And yet it was remarkable at that meeting 3 years ago, there was almost no discussion of the impending crisis. It was as if you had this, the most important event in economics in the last 75 years, and an assembly of economists that was supposed to be thinking about what are the major problems facing our societies missed this critical event. The test of any science is prediction. And if you can't predict something as important as a global financial crisis of the magnitude of the one that we're going through, obviously something's wrong with your models. In fact, as I mentioned, in some quarters, there's a complacency that macroeconomics is in its golden age. I think if it isn't its golden age, it's a very tarnished gold. The standard models not only didn't predict the crisis, in some ways it was worse than that. They said bubbles couldn't happen. They asserted that the shocks that an economy experiences are exogenous, not endogenous, and these shocks were endogenous. The kinds of research that Roger Myerson talked about, trying to construct a model where the shocks are endogenous, are exactly the kind of direction in which we ought to be working. In fact, the policy frameworks adopted by central banks, many of you are from central banks, suggested that keeping inflation low and stable was necessary and almost sufficient for stability and growth. The governments didn't have the instruments to prevent bubbles, and that it was cheaper to clean up the mess after the bubble broke than to interfere with the wonders of the market. Each of these properties is not true in general. In a sense, the models that most economists use focused on deadweight losses associated with the distortions in allocations associated with inflation. We're focusing on second, I would say even third order effects, and ignoring the first order effects of the losses associated with financial fragility and the breakdown of the financial system. The losses that have occurred as a result of this crisis in terms of gap between potential and actual GDP in the order of trillions of dollars. The gaps of the deadweight losses that were associated with the Carpenter Triangles were much, much smaller than that. One of the things that many of the presentations at this conference have pointed out is that all models are simplifications. All models have to represent assumptions that simplify the real world. The criticism of the DSGE models and the other standard macroeconomic models is not that they're a simplification. The criticism is the wrong simplification. They included things that were second order and didn't include things that were first order. And I'll come to some of that a little bit later. It's not only that they didn't predict the crisis. It's not only that they said the sources of the crisis could not be a source of crisis. But even after the bubble, which they said could not occur, broke in 2007, economists like Bernanke claimed the effects were contained. The models, the theories on which they were basing their policies and on which their analyses were based, said that that was the case. In those models, there's risk diversification. They did a calculation, a reasonable calculation, based on those models, that if you take even the subprime mortgage market, you diversify it in a global economy. It was a small fraction of global wealth, and therefore, the breaking of a bubble in the subprime mortgage was so small that it would not have any global macroeconomic effect. They were wrong. And we have to understand why the models, which continue to be used, were so wrong. Not surprisingly, such models have not only failed to predict the crisis and to give us insights into the causes of the crisis, not surprisingly, the advice they gave to governments on how to respond to the crisis was also inadequate. The nature of this inadequacy is at least hinted by the fact that now it's been almost 4 years since the beginning of the recession. Recession began in December of 2007. We're now in 2011. Unemployment levels remain very high. The likelihood is that, at least a very significant likelihood, that we'll be going into double dip. Even if we don't go into double dip, almost surely growth in the United States and in Europe will be too slow to create enough jobs for the new entrants in the labor force. So the jobs deficit will be increasing. Let me just give you a couple of examples of the kinds of things that were not included in the macro models that should have been included. Last night I was sitting with somebody from one of the central banks, and I somewhat jokingly asked him, in the model that they use, a DSGE model, did they have a banking sector? And of course I knew the answer. The answer was no. Now, to me it's amazing that a central bank has a model of the financial economy, of the economy, in which there are no banks. Why do we have central banks? There has something to do with the banking sector. And yet, the standard models leave out credit. And this is clearly a credit cycle. This is clearly a problem of credit. And if you don't have credit modeled well inside the model, how are you going to give advice about how to restore the credit flow? Let me give you another example, securitization, a central part of what has happened to the financial system in recent years. Most of the models, or almost all the models, simply assume that securitization works. It helps diversify risk. But there are, in fact, inherent problems with securitization that have been pointed out in the economics of information 20 years ago. It's not just an accident of the problems with rating agencies. They are inherent problems. So it's not a surprise that the attempts of the Fed to restore securitization have totally failed because they haven't understood what is required to make securitization work. Well, I could go on, and I should just mention one thing to tease the central bankers. You may remember that after the crisis, Greenspan was called to testify to Congress, and he said he's discovered a flaw in his reasoning. The flaw in his reasoning was that he expected banks to be able, have an incentive to manage their risk better. But I was surprised at Greenspan's surprise. Because the one thing that economists agree on is that incentives matter. And you looked at the incentives that the bankers had, and they had incentives for excessive risk-taking and short-sighted behavior. If the bankers had not behaved in the bad way that they did, we would have had to rewrite microeconomics. Fortunately, we don't have to rewrite our textbooks. Unfortunately for the economy, they behaved in the way that we predicted, but the regulators didn't understand. Moreover, if I make a mistake, if I gamble excessively, it doesn't have any consequence except for me and my family. But if the banks, a large bank, engages in excessive risk-taking and fails, it has societal, systemic consequences. That's why we have externalities. And yet we had regulators that didn't understand the reason that we have regulation. And if you don't have regulators who understand regulation, it's not surprising that things didn't work well. Well, in a way, not only is there a crisis in our economy, there ought to be a crisis in economics. Because many of the propositions that we have held very strongly have been shown not to be true and to come under challenge. To give you one other example, much of the macroeconomics have said that the underlying problem are wage rigidities. And yet, strikingly, among the countries that perform most poorly in terms of persistence of unemployment is the United States, which has allegedly very flexible labor markets. And countries like Germany that have more intervention have actually performed much better. There actually is some econometric work that I did with Bill Easterly and Ramin Islam a number of years ago that showed that this is actually a pattern, that the source of much of the instability is not wage and price rigidity, but financial instability, financial problems, of which this crisis is the most recent example. But most of the macroeconomics ignored these lessons. Another quandary, puzzle is that there were large losses associated with the misallocation of capital before the bubble broke. In fact, no government has ever misallocated capital, wasted resources on the scale of the American financial system. And it's not only the hundreds of billions of dollars that were misallocated before the crisis, but as I mentioned before, the trillions of dollars of gap between potential and actual output in the subsequent years. Now, of course, easy to construct models of bubbles, but most of the losses occur after the bubble breaks, in this persistent gap between actual and potential output. Standard theory predicts a relatively quick recovery as the economy adjusts to the new reality, but sometimes the recovery is very slow, and most of our models do not explain this kind of persistence. Well, it should be clear, I think, that there is a need for new economic thinking, especially in macroeconomics. And I think it's fortunate that there have been a number of foundations and individuals that come together to help support the creation of some new ideas. The Institute for New Economic Thinking in New York is particularly supportive of young economists. You should look at their website because it does provide grants for economists looking for support for more innovative directions. Trying to create a network of economists that are focused on understanding some of the deficiencies with existing doctrines. This morning, in the limited time I have available, I want to talk about two issues that may help us understand what has happened. And much of my research in the last few years has been focused on this, and I only have time to talk about two issues. The first is that there have been large and often adverse changes in the economy's risk properties, in spite of supposed improvements in markets. Example I already hinted at was the moving from banks to markets predictably led to deterioration in the quality of information. But another one that I'm going to be talking about is that the increased interdependence among financial institutions has led to more financial fragility. That's one of the issues I'm going to talk about. The second is that the global economy is undergoing a major structural transformation. Structural transformations are associated with extended periods of underutilization of resources that are associated with deep market failures. There's an important role of government to facilitate this transformation because of these market failures. There's an analogy here to the Great Depression. The Great Depression was a period of structural transformation. In the 19th century, most individuals made their living by working in agriculture. And then success in agriculture led to the enormous increase in productivity in agriculture. But that meant relatively few people were necessary to grow the food that people wanted. Today, about 3% of the population is engaged in employment in agriculture in the advanced industrial countries, and they produce more food than even an obese society can consume. Today, the analogous issue is manufacturing. There's been an enormous increase in manufacturing productivity, 6-7% or more. But that means that the ability to absorb employment in manufacturing, even if we consume more cars than our planet can survive, more flat panel TVs, means that people will have to move out of manufacturing, both exacerbated by globalization, which means the locus of this activity will be also changing. This is a structural transformation that is going on today. The important lesson of this is fixing the financial system is necessary, but it's not sufficient to address our problems. And so it's important that we go ahead and do the work of fixing, which we have not done, but we should not be surprised that when we fix the financial system, the economies will not be returning immediately to robust growth. So let me talk very quickly about each of the two ideas that I want to focus on. The first is, does increased interconnectivity lead to more or less systemic stability? The standard answer is that spreading of risk with concavity leads to better outcomes. But economic systems are rife with non-convexities, illustrated, for instance, by bankruptcy. And the result of this is that interlinked systems are actually more prone to system-wide failures with huge costs. And the underlying concept here is that privately profitable transactions may not be systemically desirable, socially desirable. The basic idea here, in a way, is a theorem that tried to explain why the fundamental welfare theorems of Adam Smith and Aaron DeBrew were wrong. One of the most fundamental ideas in economics is that the pursuit of self-interest leads, as if by an invisible hand, to the well-being of society. But what we've learned is that when information is imperfect, risk markets are incomplete, which is always the reason that the invisible hand often seems invisible is that it's not there. That the economy is in general constrained, Pareto inefficient. And the particular aspect of this that we're concerned with is that the privately profitable contracts can lead to large elements of systemic risk in the absence of regulation. And this crisis is a good illustration. In a way, the standard frameworks illustrate the incoherence in modern macroeconomics because international institutions, I won't name any of them, but you know who I'm talking about, argue for the benefits of diversification integration before a crisis hits. But after the crisis, what do they talk about? The word that they use is contagion. What do we normally do when somebody has a contagious disease, or what we used to do? We quarantine them. So we say we don't want integration, we want to isolate. Well, if you had a coherent model, you would recognize that, yes, there are some benefits to integration, but yes, there are also some costs. And we have to integrate the benefits ex ante and the cost ex post. If we could eliminate crises, then we could say we can just focus on the benefits. But in fact, the crises are inherent, inevitable. And therefore, we have to balance out the optimal system design, balance out the benefits and the costs. There's an analogous problem that may give some intuition into what we're talking about. With an integrated electric grid, the excess capacity required to prevent a blackout can be reduced. But the consequence, and we've done some experiments on this, when we have a more integrated electric grid, a failure in one part of the system can lead to a system-wide failure. And we've had some experience in the United States. We had a more integrated system, and then we had a little problem in Ohio led to a blackout along the whole East Coast. And that's what we've seen in this crisis. A malfunctioning in one economy in the United States brought down the global economy. Well, in electricity and the design of electrical networks, well-designed networks have circuit breakers to prevent the contagion and the failure of one part of the system to others. But economists have missed this fundamental insight. Now, one of the aspects of modern economics is that there are rational expectations. And I've been a very strong critic of rational expectation. I'm going to give you one example of irrational expectations. I always expect that I can talk faster than I can. And so I thought I was going to have time to present a model and then go derive some results. And I'm not going to be able to do that. So here it is. If you have quick eyesight, you can read it. Here, I'll go even faster. Okay, now we have. The basic insight is that even with mean-preserving reductions in risk associated with risk pooling, the probability of any particular country falling below the bankruptcy threshold or the crisis threshold may increase with economic integration. And there's some further results that are quite general. One of them is that full integration never pays if there are enough countries. There are some degrees of integration that are desirable, but the optimum involves less than full integration, and that there ought to be restrictions on capital flows. In other words, capital flow restriction can be viewed as analogous to circuit breakers. In some of the theoretical research I've been involved in, there are two further directions of modeling I'll mention very, very briefly. One of them is a concept to call trend reinforcement. When you have a negative shock, it increases the probability of the stochastic process moving down further. For instance, the result of equity depletion, interest rates that a firm will have to pay increases. And we've modeled systems by using coupled stochastic differential equations. This is some work with Stefano Battistone in Zurich and some Italian economists. And what we've shown is that, again, with this kind of trend reinforcement, there's an optimal degree of diversification. Another set of ideas has been explored in some work that I've done with Bruce Greenwald and some work that a former student of mine, Franklin Allen, has done with his colleague, Gail. And that's a concept called bankruptcy cascades, where the bankruptcy of one firm affects the likelihood of the bankruptcy of those to whom it owes money and other people in the credit network. The important point is that the architecture of the credit system can affect the risk that one bankruptcy leads to another. In other words, we can affect, by analyzing the architecture of the credit system, we can affect the likelihood of these kinds of bankruptcy cascades. There is a broad agenda here that I've called the architecture of economic systems, where we focus on the optimal architecture with respect to risk sharing. And one of the points that is very natural when you're looking at these models with non-convexities is that the solutions that appear are not in general going to be symmetric. One of the things that also comes out is that different architectures may lead to a greater ability to absorb small shocks, but less resilience to large shocks. And that's been a characteristic of many of the so-called improvements in the financial markets in recent years. One of the corollaries of the Greenwald-Stiglitz theorem that I mentioned before is that reducing the set of admissible relationships and behaviors can have benefits. A more general observation is in large nonlinear systems with complex interactions, even small perturbations can have large consequences. So there's a broad agenda ahead in the design of optimal networks, including the optimal degree and form of financial integration, the design of circuit breakers, and so forth. Well, as I say, there is a large literature that I've referred to here that's beginning in this area. The second topic that I want to talk about very briefly are the issue of structural transformation. The suggestion that the current crisis is partly a structural transformation. And as I mentioned, the Great Depression was a structural transformation for agriculture to manufacturing. This is a structural transformation from manufacturing to services. The fact is that productivity growth is now well in excess of the growth in demand, implying a decrease in demand for labor in manufacturing. And the problem, both then and now, is that if labor gets trapped, and I'll explain in a second what I mean by trapped, in a declining sector, then income will decline. In a sense, while productivity growth in perfect markets is welfare enhancing, when we have market imperfections, it may not be. The reason is that technical change always can induce large distributive consequences. One of the important implications is that representative agent models that don't take account of these distribution changes are never going to have insights into what is going on in the macroeconomy. With perfect markets, the implication, of course, is that winners could compensate losers, but they seldom do. But with imperfect markets, the decrease of welfare of those in the trap sector has spillover effects on others, and especially so if there are efficiency wage effects, there can be adverse macroeconomic consequences. And again, I won't have time to go through the model, but it's very easy to construct a model, say in agriculture and industry, have a productivity increase in agriculture, and the results can be summarized fairly simply. The basic result is, under certain conditions, the steady state is stable and so forth, then an increase in agricultural productivity unambiguously yields a reduction in the relative price of agricultural goods and reduces employment in manufacturing. The result is that a mobility-constrained agricultural sector productivity growth can lead to an extended economy-wide slump. The second theorem is that under the stability condition, an increase in government expenditure, particularly if it's directed at facilitating that mobility, can increase urban employment and raise agricultural prices and incomes. And again, a third condition is that a decrease in urban real product wages can increase urban unemployment and lower agricultural prices and income. Let me just comment very quickly on the role of modeling. As I said before, it's very important in models to focus on the right, make the right assumptions. Since structural transformations occur very seldom, rational expectations models are not likely to be of much help. Since the central issue is structural, aggregate models with a single sector are not likely to be of much help. Thirdly, since among the major effects are those arising from redistribution, a representative agent model is not going to be of much help. Fourthly, since the central issue entails frictions in mobility, assuming perfect markets is not of much help. And finally, the problems are exacerbated by information problems. Those can give rise to efficiency wage effects. Assuming perfect information is not going to be a good way to begin. The policy implications for this current crisis are very clear. There should be structural policies to facilitate the movement of labor that is trapped in a dying sector. Even though structural policies are part of the solution, traditional Keynesian policies, especially if they have a structural component, play a role. And this is in marked contrast to those who are now beginning to claim that most of the remaining unemployment is structural. But I have to commend Peter Diamond's remarks 2 days ago, where he pointed out that this excessive focus on structural is misguided. The real worry is that this is being used by those who want to argue that there is a new normal to which we must now accommodate ourselves, and therefore policies designed to stimulate the economy may not only be useless, they all may be counterproductive. In some of our work, what we've suggested is that these kinds of Keynesian structural policies were at the center of the recovery from the Great Depression. Let me conclude, since my time is almost up, with some very general remarks. I think this is an extraordinary, exciting time to be a young economist. We know that the models of the past are inadequate to the task before us. On the other hand, I think we have developed many of the tools. We have good models, for instance, of credit, of banking, the microeconomic. We haven't integrated them into macroeconomics, but we've developed a lot of the microeconomic foundations, models of agencies, of understandings of externalities. We understand the problems of corporate governance much better than we did 50 or 100 years ago. The real problem is, particularly in macro, is that these insights of modern microeconomics have not been incorporated into macroeconomics. There's another problem, I think, though, that with much of economics today, we have not always asked or focused on the right questions. One of the key problems today in our society, in our economy, is growing inequality. In the United States, for instance, today, 1% of the population is earning about 25% of all the income and has control of over 40% of the wealth. I was head of an international commission appointed by the UN to look at the causes of this crisis, and one of our conclusions that underlying the crisis was, in fact, growing inequality. Growing inequality diminished aggregate demand and was covered up. The diminution of aggregate demand was covered up by the central bankers as they engineered a bubble and as they had lax regulation. Interestingly, the IMF last spring also emphasized the importance of inequality and has moved inequality into their agenda because they have said that their responsibility is stability and inequality leads to instability. And so the inequality is really ought to be at the center of their agenda. But the standard theory in economics to explain inequality is marginal productivity theory. We know that marginal productivity theory cannot explain the level of inequality in our society or the changes in inequality that have occurred in recent years. Something else is going on. But I don't know about you, but most of us in our graduate courses do not spend much time talking about inequality. And when we do, it's focusing typically on things like marginal productivity theory. So this is an example of an area where we haven't been asking the right question, and the models that we've typically used have been the wrong models. Let me give a third example. We know that GDP is a bad measure of economic performance, and it's even a worse measure of well-being. Again, I chaired an international commission on the measurement of economic performance and social progress. There was unanimity that it was a bad measure. Why is that important? Well, many of you are running regressions between economic policies on the one hand and economic performance. But what do you put on the left-hand side of your regression? GDP, GDP per capita. But if you're using a bad measure of performance, the inferences you make from those regressions are wrong. They're not going to get better societal performance. They're not going to lead to increased well-being of citizens. So another important agenda is to try to think, how do we get a better measure of well-being, one that reflects the well-being of citizens, taking into account sustainability? You know, before the crisis, many people in Europe looked at America and said, oh, we ought to imitate the United States because it was growing more rapidly, growing on the basis of per capita income. You don't hear that so much anymore. But the most important point is to realize that median income today in the United States is lower than it was in 1997. All the growth has gone to the upper part of the population. Most Americans' incomes have been going down or stagnating year after year. That's not a good economy. An economy that compromises the environment for the whole world, an economy that leaves most people stagnating, a lot of people in poverty, is not a good economy. So it's important to get better measures of performance and try to understand what are the policies that lead to better measures. I don't know how many of you noticed as you walked into the hall that there are some posters on the wall outside. And one of those posters says, a lot of those posters are very critical of the economics profession, and I think with some justification. One of those signs say that an alternative world is possible. 48 years ago, when I decided to change from being a physicist to becoming an economist, I thought another world was possible. I thought economic science could help provide the foundations of this other world. I saw around me as I grew up a world marked by economic instability, episodic recessions, unemployment, inequality, discrimination, poverty, in a country with a great deal of riches. And it seemed to me at that time that another world was possible. I saw a rich country in a world in which most countries were in poverty. And that also seemed wrong in a fundamental sense. And so if we're going to create that, I think we have to have an understanding of economic science and the broader social sciences. I still believe that that alternative world is possible. A couple of weeks ago, I was in Spain, and some of you may know that there has been a big civil protest movement going on in Spain. People had come from all over Spain, a group of people that called themselves the indignados, the indignants. And most of them were young people. I think they were right to be indignant. The unemployment rate among the youth in Spain is over 40%. These are young people who've worked hard to get an education, to get the skills, and yet the economy, society, is not providing them any opportunity. There's been a failure of our economy and of our society, and they are right to be angry and to be working for an alternative world. So I hope some of you will devote yourself to an economic science, not only to making bankers wealthier, not only to making financial systems work better, but also to help create this alternative world, a world which there is greater social justice, a world in which we do a better job at protecting our environment, and which the focus is on the enhancement of the well-being of all the citizens of our societies. Thank you.
Der amerikanische Wirtschaftswissenschaftler und Nobelpreisträger Joseph Stiglitz über seinen Glauben an eine alternative Welt mit weniger sozialen Ungleichheiten und einem sanfteren Umgang mit unserem Planeten. Stiglitz hat seinen Vortrag am 26. August vergangenen Jahres gehalten, beim 4. Treffen der Wirtschaftsnobelpreisträger in Lindau am Bodensee.
D-Radio Wissen. D-Radio Wissen. Hörsaal.